stories of fortitude in these islands 2 years ago were just as thrilling. But perhaps they were not so vividly told as these young reporters are telling their stories today.
Why, they're beaming at you, Mr. Patterson, these gray-haired youngsters.
Oh, well, youth will be served. But since I was here last, American forces have reached Britain in great numbers, and the spearhead of these forces is the 8th Air Force. All these visiting firemen around this microphone have seen that superb organization in action, and most of our listeners have heard the extraordinary stories of the boys in the 8th Air Force, the men who faced the first team on the Axis side of the line every day.
And that brings us to...
Well, just this, Beatty. Our American forces are contributing a fresh point of view and an experimental turn of mind. The 8th Air Force Bombardment Group is a case in point. That story ought to be told as often as possible. These flying fortresses and liberators were designed and built to hit small targets precisely in daylight in the ocean waters surrounding the United States. They were brought over here because England presented an opportunity to experiment for the future of our own national defense. Some American experts, even part of the more seasoned British opinion, had grave doubts about fortress performance in this particular war theater. And when the experiment began, daylight precision bombing had not been proved under extreme conditions.
Yeah.
They gave General Acker one of the toughest jobs a man ever had. The job of proving whether the fortress could do what it was never built to do. Mm-hmm. If it could bomb German targets through Luftwaffe fighter defense and do that work successfully, well and good. If it couldn't, the whole American theory of Army aviation would have to be re-examined. The only way General Acker could prove the theory was to stake his own life on it, together with the lives of hundreds of American youngsters.
And he did just that.
Yes. For a solid year. He and his men knew they were guinea pigs in an experiment to prove whether the fortresses could take it, and as the youngsters say, whether they could dish it out, and at the same time knock down the toughest fighter cover in the world.
And as I understand it, if this could be done on an experimental scale, then the British night bomber and the American day bomber could together saturate the German air defense.
Exactly that, and more. If this teamwork proved effective, the German would be on the air defensive conclusively. The way would be cleared for our combined chiefs of staff to carry out offensive strategy. As we all know, the experiment was a huge success. And Air Marshal Tedder's experiment in combined operations in the Middle East was a parallel air success. So that today, the Luftwaffe is on the defensive in all theaters.
And the people who try to compare one bomber with another type bomber have simply missed the point.
Precisely. Each bomber has its own special efficiency. The British Lancaster is a tremendously powerful weapon for a saturation job. The Fortress is a precision instrument. And most of us overlook something else. The high degree of training required for this precision bombing operation. You see, the dramatic type aviation warfare, the fighter, has centered our attention on the pilot of the plane. And he still carries the load. It's an amazing feat to bring back ships that are half shot to pieces. The pilot shares the credit with his radio man, his navigators, and his gunners. But when you see these crews come back, nothing is more cheering or inspiring than the way pilots, navigators, gunners, radio men all rush up to congratulate the bombardiers.
Ah, yes.
Especially the lead bombardier. Now, a close study of precision bombing brings you bang into the sharp realization that the final terrific responsibility of the whole mission rests on the bombardier. In those last few seconds of the bomb run, 45 seconds is the maximum, I understand, the bombardier not only releases the bombs on the target, but under American practice, he takes over control of the whole aircraft to assure the accuracy of fire. It is a vastly important job. Of course, the whole thing represents the closest kind of military teamwork.
Teamwork? Isn't that where you started a few moments ago?
That is my general direction. Ralph McGill has told us how the British push ahead, whatever the handicap. They don't know when they're lit. Oliver Keller here observes a basic British trait in the Air Sea Rescue Service. The men accept any odds and make any sacrifice for their comrades in arms. And Jack Knight has given us the key to the philosophy behind it. A philosophy based on a heritage of centuries. All of these qualities built the British Empire, or Commonwealth, whichever you wish to call it. But as for the United States, our youth, our experimental turn of mind, have created the fundamental driving force of America, as exemplified in the 8th Air Force. And so what we have here in Britain, and perhaps even more strikingly in Sicily, is the mature, steadying force of an older nation combined with the youth of the New World.
And the final result should be obvious. Would you agree, Jack Knight?
More than that, I'd say we are too slow to recognize the other fellow's qualities. And one barrier to even better teamwork is our excessive politeness and formality. We still are not well enough acquainted. What's your reaction, Oliver?
It's too bad.
More Americans and more people from Britain can't go visiting.
Don't you think so, Mr. Patterson?
Yes. Only yesterday, Brendan Bracken, the British Minister of Information, said he wished more American publishers would come over. Perhaps he thought more of our newspapers would reflect what they saw, and what they would saw would have some value to the United States in solving its wartime problems. Anyway, two more publishers arrived here yesterday. Robert McLean, publisher of the Philadelphia Bulletin and president of the Associated Press, and Stuffy Walters of the Des Moines Register and Tribune and the Minneapolis Star Journal.
That makes about a dozen, doesn't it, Ralph?
Yes, more than that, and perhaps they will run into factory workers as I have, men, women, and girls who take an immense pride in the machines they're building, like the girls I saw in a Spitfire plant. They're thrilled to know that their handiwork is out there fighting the enemy less than 100 miles from where their work begins. They have found their place in war work, and so has almost everyone else in Britain.
Ralph, that reminds me of that tombstone you found in the cathedral graveyard in Coventry. Remember, you copied off the epitaph. It said, "To the memory of John Parks, the native of this city, a man of mild disposition, a gladiator by profession, who, after having fought 350 battles in the principal parts of Europe, with honor and applause, at length quitted the stage, sheathed his sword, and submitted to the grand victory." I trust we all sincerely believe that the modern gladiators of Britain and America shall fight the battles of this war as successfully as the mild-mannered John Parks, and that their grand victory will come in this war and on this earth. Thank you, Ralph McGill, Oliver Keller, Jack Knight, and Paul Patterson, for your mature view of the long-range facts of war. And now this is Morgan Beatty saying so long until next Saturday.
You have been listening to War Telescope, a weekly report on the war as seen from London by Morgan Beatty, NBC's veteran war observer in the British capital. Mr. Beatty is presented every Saturday at this same time, so be sure to tune in again a week from now. This is the National Broadcasting Company.